Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and birthday boy editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Helen Crane. And coming up, another MPC meeting, another rate rise. The ninth hike on the trot since this time last year took the base rate from 3% to 3.5%. But what does that mean for our money? And are we nearly there yet? Asked Simon. Also today, warnings that energy bills may not return to pre-pandemic levels until the 2030s. We offer our best energy saving tips and bust some myths along the way to help you out. And after the success of our tip warmer investigation, we turn our attention to electric heaters versus central heating. Plus how it can take 17 years for green home improvements to pay off. And Helen helps a reader still waiting for their flight refund from 2020. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, happy birthday, Simon. No, you've got to say something. Have a birthday speech. Don't just look at me like, why she mentioned my birthday. It's a special day, Simon. We celebrate you.
Thanks, Georgie. And I was just telling you and Helen before we started recording that it is a beautiful winter's morning here.
There you go.
I've still got snow on the ground. We've got clear blue skies and sunshine. Absolutely perfect. I can't remember the last time I had snow on the ground on my birthday.
Are you doing anything nice today, Simon?
Going for a walk, going for a pub lunch, seeing some of my family.
Perfect way to spend your birthday.
I'm recording this podcast.
There we go. Thank you very much, Simon. Happy birthday. The Bank of England has upped the base rate again, this time from 3% to 3.5%, the highest level since October 2008. The effort to tame soaring inflation continues despite us seeing a drop, even though a little bit, in the cost of living this week. It's the Bank of England's ninth base rate hike on the bounce in 12 months from just 0.1% back in December 2021 to 3.5% today. It's led to a significant rise, though, in mortgage rates and on the plus side, savings rates. So, Simon, firstly, the decision wasn't a unanimous one, but they still went ahead. What was the thinking behind the decision?
It was 6-3, the score that we would have wanted to see in England versus France, with 6 to England.
In just our favour, like, yeah.
Just to be 100% clear for anybody listening who hasn't quite tweaked to what I'm saying. But there was a bit of a break in sentiment because we've seen a couple of these divided votes recently, but it's been divided in the sense that the minority wanted a bigger rate rise. Yesterday, we got 0.5%, which was the same as the Fed the evening before. But it was less than we got in the bumper 0.75%. And I'm not going to mess around with 0.75 percentage points, 0.75 basis points, etc. here. Everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? I know it's technically incorrect, but that's how we all speak. So it's a little bit less. But yeah, the break was that two of the members actually wanted to hold, and one member wanted a 0.75%. So you're starting to see a slight cracking of the let's keep hiking rates into a recession resolve. I would be very surprised if we're not already in a recession, which is technically two consecutive quarters of negative growth, i.e. the economy shrinking, GDP terms. And there is a question of how bad that recession is going to be. On one side, you have a degree of resilience in the economy that I think catches people by surprise. It caught people by surprise in COVID. People do still have quite a lot of those lockdown savings that they'd built up still sitting there, if they were lucky enough to be able to build up lockdown savings. And so they have those to fall back on. To a degree, people are protected against mortgage rate rises, which we have seen and we'll talk about in a minute, but have been really quite spectacular. Most people are on fixed rates. Those on variable rates, they haven't seen them go up gradually. They've seen them go up by a lot over the last year, but they are a relatively small minority. And actually only affects about 30% of the population who are mortgaged homeowners. You've got about another 30% who are homeowners who don't have a mortgage, and the rest who rent and will eventually be impacted by landlords raising rents if they think they can get away with it in order to cover their rising costs. But many of those landlords also don't have mortgages. So there is a degree of protection there. Unemployment is still low. Wages are falling in real terms compared to inflation, but they're going up by 6.9% on average, which is pretty good. And there is, I think, as I said, just an overall degree of resilience. On the flip side, okay, you've got a generation of people with absolutely huge mortgages who, if they do have to fix because they're coming to the end of a deal, are getting absolutely hammered. The cost of borrowing money has gone up by a huge amount over the last year. If you want to buy a property now, you can probably, for the same amount of monthly payments, borrow about 25% less than you could do. That's having an impact on the property market. Sales are still going through. People are still buying, but not much. You know, it's really dramatically slowed down. How much worse is that going to get? We had the Bank of England Deputy Governor John Cunliffe yesterday saying, well, house prices have gone up by 20% since the start of the pandemic. So actually, you've got a reasonable amount of buffer going on there. It's not going to feel like that to anybody who's bought a property in that rush of property buying since the start of the pandemic and sees it go down by 10 or 20%. Property is a huge sentiment driver in this country. On top of that, people's energy bills, even with the energy price guarantee in place, are double what they were a year ago, and a year ago they were already quite high. Food inflation is running at 15%. Everything is getting more expensive. We're all seeing hundreds of pounds sucked out of our pocket at the same time as the Chancellor, in his wisdom, has decided to go on a tax raising spree, and the Bank of England is raising interest rates substantially into recession. So that's the flip side of why you would say, well, hang on a minute, how much further do we want to keep going? Now the problem is, there is a question as to who's calling the shots here. Are the Bank of England calling the shots, or is the Fed calling the shots? Are we having to raise rates because the US keeps raising rates? There is an element of that.
It's a very different situation, is it not? It looks like the Fed have got a handle on inflation. It's a different situation here, though, no?
Well, so both the Fed and the Bank of England see inflation falling away quite dramatically from, say, the middle of next year. And we've got a scenario where perhaps inflation has peaked in both countries. Peaked a bit earlier in the US. Maybe now the inflation figure came down 10.7% this week from 11.1% the month before. So October 11.1, November 10.7. We might have seen the peak here. And in fact, the Bank of England said yesterday that it thinks the peak will be a bit lower than it originally forecast due to the extension of the energy price guarantee scheme, even though that involves people's bills going up, because it's going from £2,500 for the average household to £3,000. So you could see a little spike in inflation come April when that happens. But broadly speaking, a lot of inflationary pressure is ebbing away. Shipping costs absolutely collapsed. You're starting to see a bit of a glut of some of the materials that people were struggling to get their hands on, for example, building materials and stuff like that. But how low is it going to go? There's this idea that it's going to fall all the way down through the 2% target, go below that, and then come back to 2%. I'm not so sure in this country whether that's going to happen. I think it's going to prove to be stickier in the UK than it is in the US. The US doesn't suffer quite so badly from the same energy and fuel price inflation as we do. Arguably, grows a lot more of its own food, things like that. And the US economy, as you say, it's a slightly different picture. Their economy is running red hot. Some of the inflation there is being driven by that. There was also this colossal stimulus from President Biden when he came in. So actually raising interest rates there and suddenly, you know, really dragging that inflation rate down might really drag it down and keep it down. In the UK, I think we're a little bit more at the mercy of what's going on in the world. And as we found out this year, in 2021, and in 2020, and in probably quite a few of those years before 2020, it's very difficult to predict what kind of mad stuff is going to happen in the world next.
That is very true, Simon. That is very true. But Helen, for those with mortgages, they must be looking at this and thinking, oh, you know, middle of a cost of living crisis, our energy bills have just gone up. We've already seen 8 previous rate rises. Now we've got another one. When is this going to stop? And actually, how much influence do the Bank of England have over inflation when so much that's driving it are external factors?
Sure. And I think actually following on from Simon's point about the US and UK economies being slightly different, the way that the mortgage market and housing market works in the US is also slightly different. So in the US, house prices tend to be slightly more affordable compared to wages. So mortgage payments can be a bit more affordable compared to how much people are earning. And also in the US, people tend to fix their mortgages for much longer. So they won't necessarily be as much at the mercy of rates going up. You know, it'll be an issue for people maybe buying their first home, rates will be higher. But people who are already fixed into a mortgage might be fixed for 20 years. So this really isn't going to affect them too much. But when it comes to the UK, yeah, the cumulative effect of these rate rises, it's brought payments up a lot for a lot of people. Hundreds of pounds for people on variable deals or people who need to fix as their existing fix has come to an end is quite likely. The question we're seeing now is how far have these rate rises been priced in? So base rate has been going up for a year now. And the question is, have banks kind of, have they expected this and they've already put mortgage rates up further than the base rate, kind of knowing that it would continue to go? The consensus is that probably some of it has been priced in. So rates might not now rise as much as they have after the previous base rate increases. But if you take all of the rate rises as a, you know, cumulative kind of effect, people who are fixing a new mortgage are definitely going to be seeing a huge rise compared to when they previously fixed 2 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. If you look at rates now, the average 2-year fix is 5.84%. This time last year, even, it was 2.34%. And if you look at the year before that, that was when rates were still, you know, the cheapest ones were around 1%. So if you look at it in the sense of what rates were all coming off and what rates are they going on to, yeah, it's going to be, payments going to be a lot higher for a lot of people.
It must be quite a difficult decision, I guess, at the minute, Simon, for anyone who is coming off a fix. Do I sit on a standard variable and just wait it out, or do I fix now?
This is the big question that's facing a lot of people. And I feel very sorry for anybody in that position, because essentially they're being asked to play another round of property market casino. What do I gamble on? And I don't think that that's how buying a home and owning a home should really work. I think the system in this country is very much busted, ranging from too high house prices, which stretching wages to an unbelievable level. And you're like, should I afford this? What will happen? Will they go up? Will they go down? We're looking at mortgage rates where it's like, do I fix? Do I not fix? Do I get caught out here? If I lock in for 5 years and then rates go down, am I going to be kicking myself and facing tens of thousands of pounds in early repayment charges to get out of it? If I go for a tracker or I go on a standard variable rate, could things move against me? It's a very difficult decision. And actually, this is where I'd recommend speaking to a good mortgage broker who can talk you through the ins and outs of your situation. And it very much depends on what your situation is. How much buffer do you have in your finances? If you have a buffer in your finances and you could afford for things to go against you and you're not going to get very upset that they do, maybe you can go onto a tracker rate, or maybe you could even go onto the standard variable rate. Some people might find their lender's standard variable rate is cheaper than the new fixed rate deals that they might be offered. And then you can sit it out for a bit. Hopefully mortgage rates are going to come down a little bit more in the new year, because as Helen said, they've run well ahead of the base rate. And we are in a curious scenario where base rate is continuing to go up and mortgage rates are continuing to go down. At some point we're going to reach an equilibrium there, though, and they're not going to keep coming down. They're not going, probably not going to keep coming back down to 2.34%, for example. So where do you go if you're going for a tracker? What you need to do is look at the how high are interest rates forecast to go, what's the peak forecast to be, add a bit in to give yourself some wriggle room, and then say, okay, if they go all the way up to there, am I still going to be paying less than I would do on that fixed rate? But then think, okay, what happens if suddenly there's another little panic and those expectations change dramatically? Because not that long ago, we were talking about expectations of base rate at 6%. So what if it goes to 6%? What happens then? That's your kind of outlier scenario, but you need to build that outlier scenario in. And then there's the question also for people of how long do you fix for? I've always been an advocate for fixing for 5 years, because 2 years goes very, very quickly. 5 years gives you the extra stability. Most people stay in their property for at least 5 years. And if you can lock into a good rate, then that's a great idea. But at the moment, the cost of locking into those 5-year fixed rates is way above what it was. And you've got to be thinking, are you going to find yourself in a situation where rates go down? And that happened actually just after I bought my first flat. So we fixed for 5 years at 4.99% in 2006. And that was a great deal. So you've got to put this in context, haven't you? In 2006, a 5-year fix at 4.99%, my argument was that is a fantastic deal. When are you going to be able to fix below 5% for 5 years? How many times are you going to be offered that opportunity? This is well worth taking. And actually, it did prove to be pretty much worth taking, because mortgage rates went up after that. If it had been a year and a year and a half later and I'd fixed for 5 years, I'd have been fixing at six or six and a bit. And then the credit crunch hit, the financial crisis, the emergency base rate cuts, the mortgage market totally froze. And for a while, it would have looked great to be on one of those rates, because you just couldn't get your hands on a mortgage. And lenders were doing what they did in September time. They were pulling deals, they were repricing upwards and everything like that. And then things started to filter through and mortgage rates started to come down. And there were people who would have fixed at that higher rate for 5 years and been kicking themselves. Meanwhile, people who took out tracker deals were seeing their rates slashed. There were people paying less than 1%. There was the talk of what happens if your tracker rate goes negative, because the mortgage market was so crazy in the run-up to the financial crisis that mortgage lenders were offering trackers below the base rate minus a certain amount. And that meant that some people would have, in theory, had to have their lender pay them money because they went into a negative mortgage rate. It didn't happen. The lenders didn't pay them money. And the irony was, of course, that many of the people who benefited from those lowest rates were the people who'd taken the biggest gambles. Tracker rates, big interest-only mortgages, and so on. Those are the people who saw their payments fall. Well, those who'd done the prudent thing and fixed for 5 years ended up locked into 6% rates. So that's the worrying scenario for people. But this is, as I said, why you want to talk it through with a good mortgage broker. Do the sums, work it out. If you go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder, you will find our mortgage finder, which is powered by LNC, which is a mortgage broker, okay? And if you use that, it will show you the best rates that you could apply for based on your mortgage size and your home's value, or the value of the home that you're potentially buying. You can play around with the numbers. You can speak to one of LNC's brokers on the phone. It's fee-free. That's why they're our partner. They can talk you through it. There's no obligation to do anything or take anything out. Full disclosure, if you do take out a mortgage, they'll earn a commission and we'll earn a small commission, which is what keeps This Is Money free to use and pays our wages and all those other things. But that's a long way down the line. You don't have to do anything. You can just use it as a really good resource for finding out what you need to know.
Helen, let's focus, I guess, on positive of rates rising is obviously, as Simon was talking about, some people still have quite a bit of lockdown savings left over. So, rates are going up, but have we seen a peak there?
Possibly, yes. I think the consensus is that fixed rate savings deals have hit a peak. Seems like they're coming down slightly from the level they were at maybe a couple of months ago. So I think the typical 1-year fixed savings deal is around about 4.2-4.3%, which is still good, very good compared to where they were, following the pandemic when they were really, really low, paying, you know, almost nothing in a lot of cases. So they're still good. I think on fixed rates, yes, they perhaps have peaked. Easy access, though, rates are still going up. So I think around 3% is the best easy access, which is, yeah, good. Not quite sort of hitting where the base rate is now, but a good rate. So it's fairly decent news for savers. And again, if you look at what's happened since the base rate started going up, it looks quite good. So this time last year, the average easy access was 0.2%. The average is now 1.53. So, you know, that's pretty decent. The news for savers isn't bad, but as I said, on those fixed rates, maybe worth fixing now because it's not likely to get much better.
Finally, Simon, you ask the question, are we nearly there yet? Your thought piece for the week or that particular day. Interest rates are going up, but savers and borrowers want to know when they will peak. I don't think savings rates might have peaked already. What's your answer to that question?
Nobody knows.
Right, fair enough.
But we might nearly be there.
Your article was longer than
actually,
that.
Actually, do you know what? I said like kids in the back of the car. That all the savers and borrowers and investors, are we nearly there yet? Are we nearly there yet? Are we nearly at the peak? Who'd have thought just 1 year on from when they started raising interest rates? And to be fair to the Bank of England, they might have been way too late to raise interest. We should have raised interest rates in October 2020. The rate was cut to 0.1% as an emergency COVID lockdown measure, right? Now, it became abundantly clear through the summer of 2020 that the economy had proved much more resilient. Companies had adapted, consumers had adapted. Yes, we still had COVID lockdown measures. We were going in and out of them. That was around about the time when the government was basically cooking up madder and madder rules. The rule of six, the you could be in the pub, but only if you were sitting down. Then you could only sit down with a member of your family or household inside, but outside you could sit down with other people. You could have a drink, but you had to have a substantial meal with it, even though you were unlikely to be carousing because you were only allowed to be sat down inside with your own household, all that kind of mad stuff, right? But it was abundantly clear that despite that, the economy was doing all right. We just had Eat Out to Help Out, where everyone went bananas for Rishi's meal deal. And not just young people, pensioners, restaurants and pubs were full of pensioners taking advantage of the Eat Out to Help Out. You couldn't get a hot tub for love nor money that summer. Holiday lets, you couldn't go abroad on holiday. Impossible to find anywhere to rent in this country, right? These were all expensive things to do, okay? And people were going great guns for it. It was at that point that the Bank of England should have gone, I don't think we need interest rates at 0.1% here. And there was already some inflationary pressures starting to show. And then, you know, then we went in obviously into the winter and it was miserable and all that kind of stuff. But just because it was miserable, right, and everybody was stuck at home and it was lockdown, the furlough was putting money into people's pockets. You know, the unemployment rate had actually been much lower than we thought that it was going to rise to, and so on and so on. If they hadn't raised rates before, they should have raised rates then. Then there was ample opportunity to raise interest rates last year, and they waited until last December. But to be fair to the Bank of England, as I said, they went a bit earlier than the Fed, who were also way too late to the party. And we probably wouldn't have had to see interest rates go up by as much so quickly if we'd have started raising them a little bit sooner. Now, arguably, it would have done very little to stem the inflation that has come from the war in Ukraine, right? So the Russia's invasion of Ukraine totally changed the game, sent energy prices through the roof, oil prices as well. But that inflation was already showing quite strong. There was definitely a lot of inflationary pressure before Russia invading Ukraine. We could have acted a bit sooner on some of this stuff. So as I said, it's amazing that just a year in, we're going, are we nearly there yet? But we've gone from 0.1% to 3.5% in this country. And I think maybe when you look at it, we are nearly there. As I said at the start of the podcast, you're starting to see a bit of a crack in the voting there. Two people voted for a hold. Okay, one person voted for more, but two people voted for a hold. In the US, actually the US expectations of the peak being a bit higher came in this week, because although inflation came down and the Fed slowed the rate rises, they made a few noises that actually might have to go a bit higher than they thought. Whether that's going to be the case or not, I don't know. I don't think it is. I don't think that interest rates are going to get as high as central banks think they're going to get them, or forecasters think they're going to go. So I think we are maybe nearly there. But that's very much a parent's answer to a child of, are we nearly there? Yeah. We'll be there soon. We'll be there soon. So I don't know. I think that we're probably going to see a peak in this country of about 4%. I don't really necessarily think we're going to get to 4.5%. And I think we might manage to reach 4% by the middle of next year, by April, perhaps. I think we probably might even see the peak by April. You've got to bear in mind that there is not an MPC meeting and decision until the 1st of February from now. So there's a bit of a break.
What on earth are we going to talk about? Well, I think I know what we're going to talk about. Are we nearly there yet? You might ask the same question about energy bills. Surely we can't take much more of this. With energy bills at record highs, I'm afraid, though, the news isn't good. Some experts say gas and electricity prices may not return to pre-pandemic levels until 2030s. Helen, what? Firstly, why are energy bills so high?
This is an article that our new assistant editor, Sam Barker, wrote this week. It started off with really depressing statistics, so very sorry about this. But so 2018, the average household energy bill was around £1,000 a year. It's now around 3,500. So huge hike in that short time. What we have to remember as well is back in 2018, that was the average, but a lot of people were still paying less because energy firms were still offering these competitive deals to hook new customers in, which obviously has completely gone out of the window in the last year or so. So, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but the reasons why energy bills are still so high, it's the same old story really. So this big demand for gas coming out of the pandemic, so with businesses reopening and things like that, we weren't using as much gas during the pandemic. Now we're using more, so demand has gone up, supply isn't meeting that, which is pushing up the prices. And then of course as well, this is all being compounded by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which again has led to a squeeze on supplies across Europe.
So who is saying it will stay high for that long? Another 10 years?
Yeah, it doesn't sound good, does it? So this is energy consultants. So Cornwall Insight is one of the big ones. They've predicted that energy bills won't return to below £1,000 a year for the average household until at least 2030. And again, that's a good point, actually. This is the average household. So as we always say, if you use more, you do pay more. Although bills are capped at a certain level, it's based on the price per kilowatt hour. So people who use more will be paying more than those averages. People who use less will pay less. So that's Cornwall Insight. Auxilion, which is another energy consultancy firm, they've said bills won't fall below £3,000 a year until around July 2024. So 18 months, they're saying, until prices go even below £3,000 a year. So from next year, Ofgem will review the energy cap more often. So they do it twice a year at the moment. They're going to be doing it quarterly from then. So there will be more opportunities for the cap to fall. So Auxilion's saying that in July 2024, the cap could go down to £2,463 a year, which still, you know, much higher than it was a couple of years ago, but it does look like it will be starting to fall. But that is a long time away, and people are struggling now. It's very cold, and it looks like, unfortunately, that is going to continue into next winter as well.
Simon, what are your thoughts on this? What's the solution?
I think the biggest risk to households is that these forecasts are right. Energy bills don't come down to a more normal level for a prolonged period of time, but the support that people are getting gets pulled away, and that it actually becomes the norm that the average household is paying £3,000 a year for its energy for the next few years, because that's, as Helen said, a huge increase on what we were paying. I mean, one of the solutions here is to try to make our homes more energy efficient so that we're not just burning gas to heat our homes and then leaking the heat outside. I'm sitting here in a not particularly energy efficient home. It heats up relatively quickly, but then the heat just goes, whoom, it's gone. And it's tricky, you know, especially if you're here all day long. We talked about pensioners last week and, you know, the fact that it's all right for me because I'll go into the office and I'll go sit in the office all day long. But when you spend all day here, you really do notice it. We'll come on to this in one of the Ask an Expert reader questions shortly. But the cost of making your home more energy efficient can be quite high. And also you might feel now's not the right time to do it. So, for example, I do genuinely want to make my home more energy efficient, and I do fully intend to make my home more energy efficient. But we bought it 2.5 years ago, and our intention is to extend it and refurbish it, totally overhaul it. It's a 1960s house, a 1962 house. We bought it off the couple who bought it brand new in 1962 and had lived here, the elderly couple. And there's been, you know, some stuff done over the years. I've got double glazing, but it's clearly maybe like 80s, 90s, early 90s double glazing, and most of it isn't great anymore. A lot of the seals are shot and things like that. If you were to put in modern double glazing, it would make a substantial difference, but I'm not going to do that until I extend or refurbish the home. If you know, it's an A-frame house, so the upstairs is a timber frame, downstairs brick, upstairs is timber frame. Clearly the upstairs is nowhere near as well insulated as the downstairs, but again, I'm not going to do the insulation and the stuff up there because we're going to have to rip the whole thing apart in order to do this work. But I'm like many other people in this country in the position of, I'm not doing the building work at the moment. We've got planning permission, but I'm not doing it because the cost of doing it is so expensive and we can't afford to do what we want to do, so we're sitting on our hands in the meantime. It's quite cold outside, energy prices are really high, and we're spending far more money than we need to. So we're in a slightly different position to many people because we intend to do work on a house, so we're holding off until then. We're thinking, okay, well, we'll try to get through to it. There's lots of people who don't intend to do any work on the house but still look at the cost of this stuff and go, well, I can't afford that. And the payback period, it takes quite a long time. So, you know, people need the incentive, and we've had a number of incentives pushed at us by the government, but they don't really work. And then it turns out that the money that they're making available doesn't actually go very far or isn't really available. And there's a lot of talk of the fact that if everybody did go out and start insulating their homes and doing all these things properly, there aren't enough tradesmen to do it. The other thing is, well, what do you do about the price of the energy itself? I think it has become abundantly clear to everyone since the energy market went completely nuts that the energy market is completely nuts. We generate quite a lot of renewable energy in this country. We're quite good at that. That's something that we should pat ourselves on the back for. Yet somehow we're paying energy prices based on the dirtiest possible energy, the cost of that marginal unit, the cost of keeping the lights on, right? So the whole, if there's no wind and there's no sun, we have to fire up the dirty power stations, what's the cost of that? And the cost of that gets higher the more renewable energy you have, because for a long period of time, maybe those dirty power stations are effectively mothballed. And so then the cost of then going, right, okay, we've got to keep them and we've got to then be able to fire them up, gets higher. So we've got to do something about this scenario where we are paying dirty energy prices for clean energy. And we need to become more energy self-sufficient. And I think that households across the country and households across the world would be quite right to be quite angry with their governments, because making sure that people have enough energy at a reasonable price to heat and light their homes is a basic function of a modern day economy and is a basic requirement of the government that runs it. And it's all very well saying, well, it's Vladimir Putin's fault because he invaded Ukraine, but we had a bit of warning that something like that might happen. This stuff's been rumbling on for 10 years and we've become more dependent on imported energy. Europe has become more dependent on Russian gas over that period of time. So yeah, we need to have a good, long, hard look at ourselves maybe. I just think we're very short-sighted. For example, do you remember the solar panels boom? Lots of people installed solar panels. They got paid quite handsomely in terms of the feed-in tariffs and things like that. And yes, there was a bit of a middle-class subsidy and everything like that. But because it was a bit of a middle-class subsidy, we suddenly freaked out and massively cracked down on the benefits of getting solar panels. So it suddenly slowed dramatically. Now, I do think we needed to stop the whole thing where someone would phone you up and offer to rent your roof and put some panels on it. You'd get the energy savings and they'd collect the money, which caused all kinds of problems for people. But the encouraging people to get solar panels thing and maybe paying them a bit over the odds to do so and giving them a decent reward, there was a reason for that. It was the means to an end. And the end would have been better if we had continued those means for a little bit longer. But instead, we got a bit short-sighted. Energy prices were low. We were bugging the middle class too much money. Now, we're going to have to stop this. But actually, then we would have found ourselves in this position when energy prices are high, having to worry that little bit less about subsidising middle-class, wealthier households' energy bills, because they'd have been doing a bit of the work for themselves, because more of them would have solar panels. The same thing with the insulation. I think we should give people an income tax break for insulating their homes. Basically, you pay to get your homes insulated, you can claim a credit back against your income tax. The middle class love a tax break. They love what looks like a good deal. That would get people insulating their homes. Yes, it will cost us some money, but then we wouldn't have to freak out so much about paying people's energy bills.
Simon, make no bones about it. The real answer lies in wearable duvets and tip warmers, doesn't it?
We did research those the other week, and yes, exactly. Perhaps it does. Yeah.
Perhaps it does. Coming up, we will share some tips about what you can do to keep energy costs low and bust some myths about it. But that's it for part one.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
Welcome back. We were left in no doubt this week that winter is well and truly here. Very pretty snow, as Simon says on his birthday. Very bad news for households struggling to afford to heat their homes the way that they would like to. Just one in five of us are putting central heating on as much as we need to. This is according to research by YouGov last week. Even worse, 15% of people can't afford to heat their properties at all. Now, there are a few ways to save money on energy bills and heat your home for less. And there's some that aren't perhaps quite so effective. So, Helen, let us separate fact from fiction. Let's start with giving us some of the tips that do actually work.
Yeah, so obviously since the energy crisis started, everyone and their dog has been trying to put out energy tips that will apparently save you money. I think the worst one I ever heard was doing star jumps. But now we've been in the energy crisis for a while. People have kind of worked out the wheat from the chaff in terms of these energy tips. So we've had a look at the things that do actually work and the things that are kind of common myths. Some of the things that people should be doing that will save them money. So draft proofing, number one, it's quite a basic one, you know, not necessarily hugely expensive to do. This is things like essentially filling the gaps around your doors and windows and floorboards with things like foam strips, brushes, plastic seals, and kind of things, you know, you can go down to B&Q or another DIY retailer and buy sort of relatively cheaply. It's a small outlay, but apparently it could save you £30 a year on your energy bills and make your house feel much warmer. Another one is tweaking your boiler settings. This apparently could save you more than £100 a year. So boilers have flow temperature. This is basically the temperature that they heat your radiators to. The most efficient setting, according to the charity Nesta, is 60 degrees. Now, a lot of people's flow temperature is set to 80 degrees. So by turning that down, that's a relatively easy way to save £100 a year. Shouldn't make much of a difference to how warm your home is. So that's one to have a look at. Other ones we've got, this interesting one actually. So the little numbers on your radiator dial, they're apparently called thermostatic radiator valves. I didn't know that. I thought they were just the numbers on your radiator. Obviously they set the level of heat that each radiator gives out. this tip is basically just to use them, set them to the level you need them to, and that will bring your bill down. If you can turn it from a 5 down to a 3, you don't feel much difference. That could apparently cut your energy use by up to 40%. So quite a significant saving on that one. Other ones, quite common sense, only use things like your washing machine and dishwasher when they're actually full. Yeah, this is another tip that could work, might actually cost you a lot of money. If you can afford to, upgrading or installing insulation can save money, although obviously you need to look at the upfront cost of doing that.
And let's talk about the ones that perhaps we should be wary of.
Yeah, so these are those kind of urban myths. The one that I found interesting is putting reflective foil behind a radiator. So I was talking to a friend in the pub about this the other night. She lives in a kind of old-ish, I think sort of 1920s, sort of one bed flat. It's quite drafty. I think she's still got single glazing, so the heat kind of flows out of the windows. And annoyingly, as it is in many flats, the radiator is for some reason right underneath the window, really unhelpfully. She claims that she's put foil behind her radiators and it does bounce the heat back into the room. So it stops so much of it just pouring out of the window. But apparently the key here is you can't just do it with regular foil. That doesn't work. You can't just get your kitchen foil and stick it behind your radiator. You have to buy professional radiator reflective foil.
Did not know that.
Reflective. Yeah. So apparently it's £8 for a 4 meter roll. So not too expensive, depending on how many radiators you've got. And that is the thing that will make it work rather than just your baker foil. Other common myths, painting your radiator black apparently doesn't work. That would only say be 1% more energy efficient than a white radiator. So unless you particularly like the way that looks, probably don't bother painting your radiators black. Leaving the central heating on at a lower temperature all day. Apparently that isn't cheaper than blasting it out for short periods of time. Actually shorter bursts would probably be cheaper according to the Energy Saving Trust. And the other myth, using energy at night being cheaper, that is true, but only if you have a Economy 7 or an Economy 10 tariff, which is where your energy company gives you a special rate if you use your energy outside of peak times. If you're on a standard energy tariff, that is not going to make any difference whether you kind of put your washing machine on at 7 p.m. or midnight. Doesn't make any difference. So unless you're on that kind of tariff, you're free to use stuff whenever you want.
Righto. So that's that. One reader question we have, Simon, you did allude to it earlier. Electric heaters. You have a reader query, someone who works from home. It's not me, by the way, but I was curious about this because my mum is a big electric heater fan, or she was in the past, wants to know if it is cheaper to use an electric heater to warm a room instead of putting the central heating on. So rather than heat the whole home, which I understand is quite drafty, is it better just to stick on that electric heater in that one room for 9 hours that they're working?
They're not talking about doing it for 9 hours. They're talking about putting it on for a quick blast.
For that long. I don't know how long.
The reader's question has, you know, said, I'm self-employed, work from home, spend most of the days alone in the house. I'm trying to avoid putting the heating on during the day to save money, but really feel the cold at times. Would it be cheaper to turn the heating on for a bit to warm up or use a fan heater that we have? So it's talking about, I'm really cold, I'm going to put the heating on for an hour. Is it cheaper to put your heating on for an hour? Or is it cheaper to put your fan heater on for an hour? That's the crucial part of the question, because these fan heaters are energy guzzlers in the sense that if you leave one running all day long, it will cost you a load of money. And probably more so than if you're heating a large area. You know, if you've got one in each room and you run them all day long, it'll cost you way more than your heating, right? But if you're just in a room and you just need to warm that room up rather than the whole house, is it cheaper to use the fan heater than the central heating? Stick it on for an hour, it'll warm you up, and then the room will hopefully keep some warmth for the time. So what you need to do is you need to work out how much that fan heater is going to cost you to run. Okay. Now, we've talked about this before, this whole like, how much does an electrical appliance cost to run? If you look at your appliance, it will have a power rating, which is usually given in watts or kilowatts. A kilowatt is 1,000 watts. This will tell you the amount of electricity it uses. And how much it costs will then depend on the price of the electricity and how long it's turned on for. Electricity is sold in a measure called kilowatt hours, which will come up as the units in your energy bill. Now, the cost of that under the energy price guarantee is capped at 34p per kilowatt hour. So if you have a 1,000 watt appliance, which is 1 kilowatt, and you run that for 1 hour, it will cost you 34p. The fan heater in question here, from the reader, they've looked at it, and it's a 2 kilowatt fan heater. So that would cost 68p for an hour to run, right? But as you say, if you work a full day and run it for that 9 hours, it will cost you £6.12. I would say that these fan heaters, the one thing about them is that they do warm up a room quite quickly and can be quite warm once you get them going. You probably wouldn't need to sit there next to a fan heater for 9 hours with it on. By the end of it, you'd be sitting there in your underwear. But we've got a handle on this whole, like, how much does an electrical appliance cost to run? But your heating, I mean, how much does your heating cost to put on for an hour? Does it cost 50p? Does it cost £2? Does it cost like £4? I mean, I just don't know roughly how much your heating costs. But you can do the same sum, actually. So what you need to do is look at your boiler. Your boiler will also have a power output measured in kilowatts. And then you can do the whole, how much does it cost per kilowatt hour? Gas is currently fixed at 10p per kilowatt hour. It's 10.3p, but that's close enough to 10p to be able to do a very simple multiplication. And the how long you have it on for. So most modern combi boilers, right, these are the ones that heat up the water immediately. You don't have a hot water tank. It heats up the water immediately. They tend to range from 24 kilowatts to 40 kilowatts. And they tend to be more powerful because they create hot water on demand. Whereas an old-fashioned system boiler, or not necessarily old-fashioned, if you have a bigger house, you will have one of these as well, which has a separate hot water tank, these tend to range between 9 and 40 kilowatts. So say you've got an average 3 to 4 bedroom house with a 35 kilowatt combi boiler, that would be 10p kilowatt hour, 35 times 10, £3.50 to run it for an hour. So there you go. You can immediately see that running your electric heater at 68p for an hour is going to be cheaper than the £3.50. With a less powerful 26 kilowatt system, you'd be looking at £2.60. If you've got a smaller boiler, for example, 18 kilowatts times 10p, £1.80. But still, you're looking at a much cheaper cost to run that electric heater. What muddies the waters here, though, is the fact that it's likely your boiler won't be running for the entire hour if you put your heating on for an hour, unless you're starting from the position of having a very cold house. If you've got a thermostat and your thermostat isn't set too high, i.e. it's not shorts and t-shirt weather in your house, say you've got your thermostat set to 18 or 19 degrees, the boiler should run to keep the house at that temperature. And once it's reached it or is about to reach it, then it won't run constantly. It will switch itself off. It will stop heating. So you might find that over an hour of having the central heating on, maybe that boiler is only running, you know, half the time. But what this does show is that it is cheaper if you're just trying to warm one room to use an efficient fan heater. And if you are going to buy a fan heater, bear in mind that some of them are much more efficient than others. And they have thermostats, they'll turn themselves off when the room gets up to a certain temperature. So you don't have it blasting for a whole hour. They might have timers. They will use less energy. Whereas then they will tend to be a bit more expensive. The cheaper ones, on the other hand, will just keep blasting hot air at you until you press the off button.
So yes or no?
Okay, it's cheap. Yes, it is cheaper. Right, to great. Almost, it is cheaper to use the fan heater.
So I should get myself a fan heater. Although be careful, because they do cause fires in some cases, so you know,
Yeah, and don't put stuff over them and things like that. And I must say, like, you can tell it's been cold this week. This story has been off the charts, the most read story on This Is Money all week. There you go.
There you go. Helen, just very quickly, as Simon was talking there about making our homes more energy efficient, bit of a strange story, actually, when you read it. A NatWest customer got this email, thought it might have been a scam, so called NatWest. And no, he was one of nine customers specially picked out, where NatWest decided to spend $190,000 making their homes fully energy efficient. Why and what was the result?
Yeah, so this is it's a rare story of a bank doing something quite generous and nice.
Why? What was in it for them?
Filled with Christmas cheer, maybe. Well, the point is that they're trying to prove. So since energy bills have been going up so much, homeowners and landlords are always being told, you know, insulate your home, get double glazing, get a heat pump. It'll cut your energy bills and save the planet. Obviously, some of these things are extremely expensive to do, you know, double glazing, heat pumps, those things cost thousands and thousands of pounds. And as Simon said, a lot of people are reluctant to do it because by the time they've got the money to do it and got it done, energy bills could be going down. So it's something that's a good idea in principle, but not necessarily practical for a lot of people. So what NatWest has done, it has called up, I think, eight of its mortgage customers and literally said, hello, would you like us to spend thousands of pounds making your home energy efficient? So the idea is that they're going to improve their EPC rating. This is a rating that basically describes the sort of energy efficiency of your home. The average in the UK is a D. And these properties that NatWest has retrofitted have got up to A's and B's, which should cut their bills. So they've gone in, they've done the improvements for them. The guy that you mentioned, Philip Asbury, he's got a drafty 1930s house in St Helens in Merseyside. NatWest has given him a makeover which is worth £17,800. So they've given him new double glazing. This has argon gas inside the panes, which apparently provides extra insulation. So new top of the range windows. He's had solar panels fitted and an air source heat pump put in his garden. His EPC rating was a D, it's now a B, which should cut his bills quite substantially. However, if he'd paid for this himself, it would cost 14 years to recoup the costs through lower energy bills. So yeah, I mean, very nice thing NatWest has done. I think that where this has probably come from is that banks are under quite a lot of pressure to make the homes that they lend mortgages on more efficient. So the government has kind of said to them, your mortgage book needs to have more energy efficient homes on it. So there's this kind of idea that further into the future, it might be difficult for less efficient homes to get mortgages. So NatWest obviously has a vested interest in encouraging people to make their homes more energy efficient. But if anything, their experiment has kind of proved that this costs a lot of money and it might take a long time for homeowners to get their money back.
Eek. Right, finally, because we're running out of time, Crane is back on the case, this time to help someone who's still waiting for a refund for flights booked for March 2020, right at the start of the pandemic. Helen, tell us more.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is still happening all the time. So I get emails every week from people who are still waiting for flight refunds from pre-pandemic or flights that were cancelled during the pandemic. This lady, so it's a bit of an unfortunate situation. Her son was travelling in Australia in March 2020 when the pandemic hit and obviously needed to get home as soon as possible. You know, the Prime Minister was kicking tourists out of the country, so he was in big panic to get home. So him and his mum booked a raft of flights. His mum kindly booked them on her credit card because he didn't have one and they kind of knew that they'd probably need to get money back for some of these because flights being cancelled left, right and centre. So long and short of it, they booked six flights. One of them successfully got him home. Great. Four of them were refunded quite promptly. One of the flights, which they booked through a travel agent called Kiwi, never got the money back. It was nearly £700. They've been contacting them since March 2020 and the money still hasn't turned up in their account.
What have Kiwi been saying? Why not?
So the thing that they've been saying, and this is something that's happened, it seems to be a real issue when you book flights through one of these online booking agents or travel agents. They'll say, well, the airline hasn't paid us the money back, so we're not giving you the money back until the airline pays the money back to us, which is kind of weaseling out, really. I mean, I understand they're a business and they have to get their money back, but I think this serves a real red flag for booking through these agents. You know, obviously 99% of flights kind of go fine. You never need to get your money back. But I do think this kind of shows that, you know, those, it can be a lot harder, because if you're booking through an agent, you're essentially facing a double waiting time. You know, you're waiting for the airline to pay the money back to the agent, and then you have to wait again for the agent to pay the money back to you, which is how they've ended up waiting absolutely years. And so it's, yeah, definitely something for people to think about if they're looking at sort of holidays for next year. Luckily, end of the story, I called Kiwi and they did pay the money back, but this was sort of a goodwill gesture out of their own pocket. So, you know, it's something that is going to take people a lot of time to get their money back. But luckily, you know, we've sorted it out for this person. For the majority of people, sadly, it's just going to be a case of bugging them until they finally give you your money back.
You know, going through my head is probably a personal finance thing, thinking, how much are they losing from rising inflation with that one? But anyway, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions to the team, anything you'd like them to look into, or you'd like to wish Simon a happy birthday. Simon?
Don't email us to wish me happy birthday, please.
Oh, go on, do.
No, don't. Please don't do that. Please. You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
You old misery. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.